Before, I believe that those of you who did not grow up from Gan with the Torah stories have the advantage here. Because those of you who grew up with the stories from Gan sort of have a preconceived notion. And let's take a look at this. The perek in front of you is a perek that you're all familiar with. It's the story where Sarah, because she is barren, decides to give her maidservant to Avraham. And our problematic pasuk appears in pasuk number 6, pasuk vav. And that is, Vayomer Avram el Sarai, hinei shifchatech biyadech, asila hatov be'enayich. So Avram says to Sarah, here is your maidservant, you do what you see fit in your eyes, and here is the problem, v'te'aneha Sarai v'tivrach mipaneha. Now how do you want to translate the word v'te'aneha? Here in the English translation that I brought before you, which comes from the Chabad website, they translate it as afflict. How else, when you hear the word inui in modern day Hebrew,
torture.
It's more like torture. Now is there a difference between afflict and torture? Yeah. Who's doing what? Okay, but we understand that the word vatahaneh is certainly a negative connotation, and it causes a Hagar to run away. Now let's just stop for a minute and understand, where is Hagar running away to? She's leaving Avraham's house. Perhaps she's going someplace specific, but for her to go to someplace specific, what is it? Even if she's not going, what does it mean for her to run away? Let's just understand this.
She's a female traveling alone
through the desert. Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. That's, I think, almost irrelevant at this point, but we understand that the fact that she is based, when she runs away, we really have to understand that she's running away and risking her life to run away. That's how desperate she is. Because she is going out to the desert, she is a female traveling alone, it's not like a guaranteed that she is going to be successful. Now basically, if I see a show of hands here, how many of you take a view that Sarah is justified in her persecution and Sarah is right and she's the tzaddiket and everything is fantastic? Nobody. Okay, so then I'm assuming that everybody in the room
is taking the opposite position.
She's holding off with her decision, waiting to see. But I'm just saying, that's what I'm asking, what kind of preconceived notions we have coming in into this chapter. Okay, so there are, as we are setting out on our semester, there are several, many stories.
Okay.
Okay.
So this is going to be
one of the techniques we're going to have to look at. I pulled out the verse without looking at the entire chapter, and we're going to have to see, does the entire chapter give us clues to how we understand this? Okay, that's correct. So she's saying even if you want to say that Hagar abused Sarah, does that, if your neighbor abuses you, does that give you the moral right to abuse your neighbor back? Right, that's what she's saying. Okay, so the different set. Okay, so let's sort of see.
Something about in your eyes. Sarah's a prophetess, apparently, so that only makes
our question stronger, is that we expect from our prophet and prophecies, what were they mostly, if you look at our major prophets, they're the ones who are there to defend moral behavior.
Unless she's seeing something.
So one thing we're going to do is we said we are going to look at the context. Before that, and what else are we going to look at besides the context, by the way? What are other clues that we're going to use to understand what's happening here? What else do we want to use? We want to use the words. We want to look at the broader context of all the stories, which is a problem I pointed that out to you. When we pull out just one chapter, we want to look at the background and the setting from the story and see if that will give us some clues as well. Now, but before we go any further, let's talk about who was Hagar. Here she's introduced to us as, in verse 1, let's go back. She's a Egyptian. What kind of Egyptian? Shifcha Mitzrit Ushma Hagar. Now, whose maidservant is she? She is Sarai's maidservant. Now, if you turn to source number 1, which is on page 3, Rashi tells us that this wasn't an ordinary personality, that Hagar was actually Bat Paro. She was Paro's daughter. And when Paro saw the miracles that happened to Sarah in chapter 12 when he takes her, he said, "It is better that my daughter be a handmaid in this household than a mistress in another household." I think the equivalent that we can understand this today is we've all met Olim from Russia who've told us that in Russia they were doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, and they said we'd rather be free in Israel and they're, you know, driving the ambulance or sweeping the floors, whatever it is that they're doing. They say we'd rather be in Israel doing this than stay in Russia doing that. So it seems to be that that's what, according to Rashi, that was Paro's position. That he said, it's better for my daughter to be a handmaid in Sarah's house than a princess in my house. Now, how does that change our perception? What do you know about Egypt at that time period? First of all, Egypt is the center of culture. Okay, and we're talking about somebody who grew up in royalty, which means she's used to being way, you know, and she's used to having all the comforts of life. And here her father says, right.
It's so interesting. Why is Rashi? She's not the first daughter of Pharaoh to.
Correct. To see otherwise.
Why does Rashi think that it's Pharaoh's daughter?
Ah, so where does Rashi get this from? You'll notice that he gets it from Bereshit Rabbah. He gets it from Bereshit Rabbah. If you go back to chapter 12 in Bereshit, it says that Paro gave La'avram Hetiv Ba'avura, and Avram benefited, and Paro gave him tzon, bakar, donkeys, cattle, he gave him a whole bunch of things. And the word maidservants there, shvachot, is written without a vav. It's written chaser. So that's what the Medrash says, because that missing vav indicates not many shvachot, but just one. So it's based on that. But I want to show you something interesting. If you look down at Gimel, that same, so there you have the Bereshit Rabbah, the Medrash Rabbah, I bought it for you in Bet. But if you skip down to Gimel, we have the same idea, but with a slight change, which might change your perception. I'm at 1 Gimel on page 3. It's, the Medrash says, Amar Reb Shimon bar Yochai, Bito shel Paro haita, V'kevan shera'ata ma'aseha shel Sara Amra, Mutav liot shifcha Sara b'beit Paro. How is this Midrash? It's the same as Rashi, but a little different. Ah, yafeh. In this Midrash, it's not Paro making the decision, but it's Hagar herself making the decision, which reminds us of other daughters of Paro that made decisions, not necessarily what their father wanted, which is an interesting idea. But here I think that changes a little bit our perception when we say that this is a life that she is choosing. Now it happens to be, and I think that's something we do need to stop for a minute and think about, that in ancient times, women really didn't have the tremendous amount of ability to choose their lifestyle. And so we need to keep that in the back of the mind. But here the Midrash takes it a little bit differently and says that indeed either it's Paro who made that decision, or it's a little easier for us to say that it was she herself, Hagar, who made this decision. I'm happy to get it. Right. Now, remember also, it's very possible that Paro had multiple children. We don't know how many, what number she was on the hierarchy of the palace. But it is certainly, I think, an important background to understanding who Hagar is, how she came into Avraham's household. Why does Sarah, what is motivating Sarah to give Hagar to Avraham? Now there are two possibilities, I think, here. What are the two possibilities? I think the clear one to us is what's she thinking?
That she can't have children.
And why is giving Hagar to Avraham going to give her children?
Because maybe he's able to have children and she's not.
And that's what she's planning on doing?
Raising.
Right. Okay. So that's possibility number one. That's right. It would be the first surrogate concept that she, Hagar, is going to be the one who has the baby, but who's going to raise the child, who is going to educate the child, who is going to be the mother of the child, technically, Sarah. So that is option number one. Option number two is the one Rashi brings here, which I did not bring you, I don't think, but here on the Pasuk where it says, Ulai Ibanemi Mena, in Pasuk Bet, Rashi says that actually Sarah thought that if she gives Avraham Hagar, that would give her a extra zechut, because she's being so unselfish, and she's giving her husband a child, and so in reward, God will give her a child. It was a little bit more convoluted than what seems to be the pshat, that she hoped that she would have a child as a result of giving her husband a child. But either way, she decides to give Hagar to Avraham. So what happens after the time they're there, and you pointed this out, Hagar immediately becomes pregnant in verse 4. Now, how are we supposed to understand the end of verse 4? Vatakel gvirta be'eneha. Here it's translated, and her mistress become unimportant in her eyes.
She gained status
because she is now carrying the child of Avraham. So therefore, what does she do? How do you understand this sentence practically? So what does she say to Sarah?
She deserves Sarah's position.
Like how?
I've done something you can't.
Sarah says it's time to unpack the groceries. And she says, do it yourself.
I'm pregnant,
my feet hurt. Do it yourself. Okay? That would have a conversation, or perhaps you could even hear it a little stronger. What would be a little nastier way of saying it? He's not going to love you anymore. I'm the one who's going to be the important one now. I need to protect. You couldn't become pregnant, and I need to protect this child of Avraham because you couldn't do it. Okay, so you could sort of hear in this expression, "Vatakel gvirta beineha," if we use our imagination a little bit, we can try to understand that it is a sort of perhaps verbal abuse that Hagar is saying to Sarah. And you have this in source number two. Rashi here says, "Vatakel gvirta beineha." Amra, Hagar said to herself, Sarai zu ein sitrat gluya. You know what, the Sarah? She's really a hypocrite. Page 3, number 2. Mar'eh atzma ki ilu hi tzadeket ve'eno tzadeket. But now I've just discovered, you know, she makes up the whole world, thinks she's so righteous and holy, but she's really not. Shelo zachta lehirayon kol ha'shanim halalu. Because obviously, v'shot tzadeket, God would have given her a child. By the fact that God doesn't give her a child indicates that God must be punishing her because she must be this big, terrible person. Va'ani, but me, nit abarti me bi'arishonah, I conceived immediately. So this just continues with that conversation. We can hear her saying to Sarah, who is her mistress, and we see her taking advantage of her pregnancy to say nasty things, to think thoughts about Sarah, to abuse the barren woman, who it's even more painful probably for her all of that time. Nevertheless, even if we do want to go that way and say that Hagar is a taking advantage, does that make you feel any better?
No.
With the Sarahs?
No, I grew up with two wrongs to make a right.
Right. Okay, that's correct. That although we can sort of sympathize with Sarah, it still does not justify her position of abuse.
On the other hand, it's an employer, it's a business. If your employee is disrespectful,
that's
a behavior,
you fire them. Okay, so that's right. There is something. Now, I think it is important for us to also take a step back and remember that this whole concept of mistress, slave, is something that's very foreign to us. This whole second wife business is something that's very, very far, very, very foreign to us. Now, I think on the simplest reading of the perek is critical of Sarah. We come out feeling uncomfortable with Sarah's behavior, and we took a look at this yesterday, last week, but we're going to look at it again. Let's look at the Ramban, which appears in 3a. The Ramban tells us, it's the bottom of page 3, Chata imenu beinoy ze. Sarah was wrong. Sarah was wrong. There's no other way to understand that statement. And look what else the Ramban adds here. Vegam Avraham behenicha cho la'asot kein. He says that let's not only point fingers at Sarah, we need to point fingers here at Avraham as well. What has Avraham done? What's Avraham's guilt here? That's what he said. He said, do what you want. If you see somebody being persecuted, you have a responsibility to interfere. And the fact that Avraham not only does not interfere, but he says, you know, knock yourself out, Avraham here too is guilty according to the Ramban. Vashama Hashem et Onya, God heard her suffering. Vinatan la ben sheyeh pera adam lanot zera avam v'sara b'chol yimei ha'inoi, b'chol minei ha'inoi. And as a result of this mistake, God gives Hagar a son who is a wild man whose name is Ishmael, who for generations he persecutes. What goes around comes around, and he persecutes Avraham and Sarah's children as a result of this mistake. I think the Ramban is really clear. There's, you know, very little room for movement here. And if we take it even a step further, let's continue with the Radak, which begins at the bottom of page 3 but continues on to page 4. The Ramban, the Radak says, and Sarah oppressed. She was too hard on her and made her perform hard labor, perhaps even struck her and cursed her, such that she, Hagar, could bear it no longer and ran away. So whereas Torah didn't tell us what that persecution was, Radak hypothesizes, based on the fact that she was willing to risk her life and run away to the Midbar, that Sarah made her perform hard labor, maybe even struck her and cursed her. He's bringing this from just what would cause a woman to run away from a secure home to basically, you know, insecure Midbar. You have to be really unhappy.
Well, and he also says, maybe she just felt like, you know, here she had been a princess. Now she was working as a servant in someone else's house. She's pregnant. And she sees that's not going to be a good situation because it's not Sarah's child, but it's Avram's child. She realizes that there's going to be tension. She doesn't want to stay there. She's got the baby. She might as well leave.
She
put up with that kind of situation? It may not have anything.
But she,
you know,
you understand that by her leaving, she's not necessarily sure she's going to live out the week.
Have
not thought it out well enough.
Yeah. I mean, she's a young girl. She may.
One second. How long is Hagar in Avraham and Sarah's house?
We don't know.
We do know. We know very clearly. It says it right there in the Pasuk. take a look at verse number 3. Remember we said Hagar became part of Avram's household when Avram goes down to Egypt. So she's minimum there 10 years. So this is a situation, she's been living happily, getting along with Avram and Sarah 10 years. Okay, so let's just finish. Let's see what else the Radak says. So the Radak comes down very hard on Sarah. We're up to the bold words. And in this matter, Sarah behaved in a manner which was not moral and not righteous. Okay, I don't think there's any other way to understand that. Not moral. So even though Avram was prepared to forgo his own respect that was at stake and said, do to her as you see fit, it would have been appropriate for Sarah to extend her hand to Hagar for Avraham's sake. Remember, she might be Sarah's servant, but she's now Avraham's wife. So doesn't she... Right, but doesn't she deserve some sort of respect for that? And not to oppress her. So that's the moral attitude. And it's not righteous or demonstrative of a good heart. For it's not worthy for a person to do everything that he has power to do. Just because you're the boss doesn't mean that it's appropriate for you to abuse the workers. And for that which Sarah did not do good in God's eyes... And listen what the Radak proof is for this, you asked. As the angel said to Hagar, for God has heard your suffering and shall bless you for your suffering. And, here's the key sentence, the whole story is recorded in the Torah in order for a person to acquire thereby good traits and distance himself from the bad ones. Which was one of the issues we spoke about last week, that sometimes Torah stories teach us what to do and sometimes Torah stories come to teach us what not to do. And so this is the approach of the Ramban and the Radak. It's very simple and I think straightforward and sort of, you know, but does it really answer all of our questions? Does it really answer all of the things that's going on? We're going to see not. Now, what I'm going to share with you now comes from Rabbi Samet. He points out, interestingly enough, that if you look at the Code of Hammurabi, which appears in source number 4. Now, the interesting thing is the Code of Hammurabi was discovered at the beginning of the 1900s, in 1901. It's written in Akkadian. It's like a finger-large rock. And on it is written 282 laws by King Hammurabi, and it was written in 1754 BCE. 1754 BCE. It's a really old law, one of the oldest, I think, law books that we have. It's presently today in the Louvre. If any of you have seen it, I would like to. But on this,
yes,
oh, you can read Akkadian. Okay, it's written Akkadian in cuneiform script. And which means that Radak, Ramban, none of these Mefarshim would have had access to the Code of Hammurabi because it really is a modern find. Now the Code of Hammurabi, I said, has 282 rules. Law 146 and 147 reads as follows. Should a man marry an infertile woman and give her maidservant to her husband, if the maidservant bears children and then equates herself with her mistress, the mistress may not sell her since she has given birth to children, and it would constitute cruelty to separate the maidservant from her children. Rather, she shall place upon her a sign of servitude and assign her as one of the maids. If she does not bear children, she may be sold. Which means that in 1754 BCE, we're understanding that it was a common practice that if a man did not have children, that he would marry the maid servant. And it's clear from this code that the woman still maintained her authority over the servant. And that she lived... But it seems to be, though, that she did gain a certain amount of freedom. This is understanding from the rules before and after what happens. Now, this seems to be that everything is fine until she changes her attitude. right? If she equates herself with her, because listen, read the words. If she equates herself with her mistress, then what happens? She reverts back to a maid, meaning, or slave. Does everybody get that from reading the words? That if the imagine, so what happens to be? What's the key here that would change? If she doesn't change her attitude, then she has a certain amount of freedom. It seems to be. You have to read it from what's not written.
Well, when it says so, so I'm looking at the words.
Okay.
And I'm seeing, should a man marry, and she gives her maidservant, and she gives her maidservant to her husband.
Right.
So it's not really clear to me, once she gives her maidservant to her husband, is she still a maidservant, or is she now a secondary wife?
It seems to be, because it says, continue reading, it continues says that, if she usurps her mistress's place
As primary wife.
But it
doesn't say that she's still a maidservant.
Right. That is not clear here. It seems to be that she must have some sort of this quasi-status. Okay? She cannot be sold, which gives her a certain amount of security. But look at this. If she does usurp her mistress's authority, the mistress may place upon her a sign of servitude. How do you understand that?
Brand.
A brand?
Yeah,
ear pierce. A dot. Okay, that's what it seems to say. It's some sort of servitude, and assign her as one of the maids. Now, how does this law of Hammurabi that existed at the time of Avraham, 1754 BCE is Avraham's time, how does this change our understanding of the story?
Where was Avraham?
It justifies Avraham and Sarah as saying that this is what was
accepted.
This is what people knew then.
But also, it looks like the law kicks in when she bears children. So she hasn't born children yet. So it may be that, you know, they're trying to do something
to prevent
before, right, because there has to be somewhat tied after she has children.
It seems more cruel to deal with a pregnant woman like that.
Now, look.
It doesn't say
that
she's pregnant.
Right. It does. It says that she becomes pregnant.
Right.
Look back.
One second.
Let's come back then. Look back. Look back. One second, ladies. Let's look again at the literature. Look back at verse 3. What is Hagar? How is Hagar given to Avraham? What is the word used in verse 3? Vatite ota le'Avraham isha lo li'isha. It could have said le'pilegesh, it could have said shifcha. It says isha, which continues, which gives us an idea that when they, which is according to the code of Hammurabi, it gives them a certain amount of freedom. Now notice Pasuk Dalet. One second. Pasuk Dalet is the first time the name Hagar appears without the title Shifcha Mitzrit. Notice that. Until then, she always appears Shifcha Mitzrit, Shifcha Mitzrit. And here, all of a sudden, Pasuk Dalet, we lose the Shifcha Mitzrit. Now take a look. Go back to the Radak. We skipped it before. To Radak. Remember, Radak is a medieval commentator. The Radak says, on the words that she, her mistress became unimportant in her eyes, she thought that Avram's offspring will be from her, and she will become the mistress. She thus disregarded the commandments of her mistress Sarah. Understanding the Radak, in the Code of Hammurabi, what essentially is she doing? She's usurping in such a way that she equates herself with her mistress, But according to the doc, not only is she equating herself with the mistress, but she's replacing. That's right. She is. She is replacing the mistress, and therefore, when Avraham says to her, "She's your maid. Do what you want." That's because the mistress. Rather, she shall place upon her a sign of servitude. According to the Code of Hammurabi, she goes back to that mistress. Now, it very well could be, as I think you were alluding to, that what is really bothering Hagar at this point? She marries Avraham, she becomes pregnant, she views herself as the new mistress. Along comes the old mistress and starts putting her back in her place. One second. According to the Code of Hammurabi, what is really bothering her? It's not only unclear status, but it is a revert. She like tasted freedom for a while. And then all of a sudden, she's being reverted back to that maidservant. So it could be, as you said, for 10 years she's been happy where she is, but then when she reverts back for that brief period of time to what she had as a child, she remembers that, and she says, and that's, so the abuse of Sarah might not be, as Radak is saying, cursing, hitting, spitting, but according to the Code of Hammurabi, what is the abuse that Hagar is feeling? This reverting back to position of
hand.
It's like,
so,
justice, though. If I was Hagar, I would say, what injustice. I came from the house of Rosie. I've grown up a bit. I was a rebellious kid. What goes around comes around. I'm royal again. Yeah.
Yeah, but it says, the code says if she equates herself with the mistress, then she she equates herself and she tried to take Sarah's place. So she, why isn't she getting, according to that, what was going on at the time that she got what was going on?
I think she thought she was entitled. I don't think she took it. I think she felt.
But that according, but see, according, apparently, by the fact that Code of Hammurabi has a rule like that, indicates that this was something that happened.
Except one thing. It's Le'isha. She's not a surrogate. She gave it to Avram as his wife. We've got a real problem here. She has become Avram's wife. Who, when in Jewish law, as far as I understand, once you're the wife of the man, his mother says what to do. Not his second, not his first wife, but someone else is under him. Right? I don't understand how this law kicks in exactly, because
but it seems to me
that
we're
talking
about
surrogate. She gives her maid servant to give birth, like.
Okay, but it seems to be from Isha. But from reading the Hammurabi, so first of all, you're asking a question. It's one that we haven't really, and we're not really going to deal with so much here. Is Avraham's position here in this whole story? But the, it seems to be that from the Code of Hammurabi, I don't know whether there was, you know, a hierarchy of how it worked in the wives. But clearly, Sarah, as the older, more established wife, is going to have the hierarchy in the house. She's the one who's going to decide what's being cooked for lunch and what we're, you know, where what we're doing. But based on this Code of Hammurabi, here is what the key point that Hammurabi adds to us is that A, this was common at that time. B, it was an accepted practice that if this maid forgot her place, she was able to, the mistress was able to put on her a sign of servitude.
So, you know, I'm thinking as we're saying this, the whole situation of Yaakov and his wives, we don't hear any of this. You know, he had two extra wives who were maidservants, and they seem to, while Rachel and Leah were the primary wives, the other ones seem to also have been, you know,
but yet at the same time, they never.
It doesn't say that they continue to do household duties.
Well, we don't know whether they did or didn't. Or primarily, I think that you're exactly hitting on the point here. But I think you are hitting on a point here that there was obviously accepted place, and when everybody knew their place, we were good. And that's why you have to have Pasuk Dalet that tells us specifically, Vatakel Gverta Be'eneha, that specifically says, she missed her place. Avraham then says to Sarah, based on the Hammurabi, you do what you want. And then Sarah Vata now Sarah afflict her. So therefore we could say that did she put a brand on her? Did she put her in a place? We don't know necessarily what it is. She's still. But it still, she still doesn't completely lose her responsibility to Sarah.
How do we know that?
Because it says very clearly, the mistress cannot sell her, and if she refuses to recognize her place, she may be put on a sign of servitude, which indicates to us that there was a hierarchy here.
But that says that just that she's given her maidservant to her husband. It doesn't say here, it doesn't differentiate that she's now a wife. But it says in the Torah that she is now given as a wife. And that may change things.
Okay, well, hold. All right. So let me, 1 second. Let me continue. If there are, okay, there are, 1 second. There are people who do want to take the Code of Hammurabi and say that that justifies Sarah's behavior, whereas we started this class saying Sarah was completely wrong. Rabbi Samet is trying to argue that based on this discovery of the Code of Hammurabi, it proves to us that Sarah was justified because this was the accepted law and this is what they know, and that was the social norm in Mesopotamia. Nechama Leibowitz comes along and rejects this approach out of hand. She says not only is the Torah not coming to justify the laws of Hammurabi, Torah is coming to say what is the difference between Torah and Hammurabi. In Hammurabi, this is acceptable behavior. In Torah, this is unacceptable behavior. And so Nechama goes along with the Rabdak and the Ramban, even knowing that this was social norms. She says, just because social norm says X, Torah expects more, and that the Code of Hammurabi does not justify Sarah's behavior in any way, and you should never compare a human text to a divine text. And so that is Nechama's approach, and that puts the Code of Hammurabi away for those of you who were not comfortable with it. And so that you could even say that although Sarah might have been legally correct, that doesn't necessarily make it morally correct. Let's jump to that. Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. Let's jump to the story of the angel. Because that is going to, we're going to need that. As we said, we're looking at the words, but it's also important for us to look at the context of what is going on. The angel speaks to Hagar four times. The first two remarks in verse 8 and 9. And he says to Hagar, Shivchat Sarai, Emi zebat va'anel telchi. Where are you going from and where are you coming? And she says, Mipnei Sarai Gvirti Anichu Barachat, I am running away from Sarai, my mistress. Vayom la Malach Hashem, and so the Malach Hashem says, Shuvi el Gvirtech, return to your mistress, Vehit Ani Tachat Yadeha, and allow yourself to be afflicted by her. And then the Malach comes along and says in 10 and 11, and I will multiply your children, and you'll have a son, and his name will be Ishmael. Now, for our purposes now, let us look at 8 and 9, because that's a key to understanding. Now, without going into any commentary, what do 8 and 9 add to your understanding here?
I just wanted to mention that 7 is interesting, because the Lord found her by a water fountain.
Right.
It means that. Torah, you just said.
Okay, and let's talk about also the fact that the Malach appears to Hagar. Malachim don't appear to everybody.
Right.
I think that's an important point. But first of all, what does the Malach call her? Hagar Shifchat Sarai. What does that tell you? That the Malach is telling her what her place is. Now, what would you have expected Hagar to say? Hagar, why are you running away? What should she have said? I'm being hit, I'm being abused, I'm being persecuted, I'm being locked in my room. You would expect her to describe some sort of persecution. She doesn't say that. Sometimes we have to look at what's said, and sometimes we have to look at what isn't said. What does she say? I'm running away from Sarah Gvirti, my mistress. Why does she add that word? Because she realizes that, and that seems to indicate to, but yet, what do we contend? The Malach sends her back. Wait a minute. Why would the, if she is indeed being abused, if she is indeed being persecuted, why in the world would God send somebody back to be persecuted?
Because she will gain something from it in the end, her children.
So would God send somebody back to a situation that is where they suffer?
It wasn't as bad as she thinks it
was. So that might indicate to us that it's clearly not as bad as she thinks it is. That has, as has been.
God sends us to Mitzrayim for 400 years. So you can't say sometimes we have to go through things that are difficult for a good outcome. So it's even though she might have been abused, it might be she had the same mind
or maybe she was thinking it was abuse, but it was really being treated as a regular maidservant. But because she thought she
her
was
perception,
the mistress, her perception wasn't coming from royalty. So for her, it was like really forward.
Okay, so let's take a look. First of all, let's begin with this question. The Malach begins with a question. Eimi zebat v'ana telchi. Where are you coming from and where are you going? Now, we all know that's what? The Malach doesn't know? Everybody, we all know very clearly where he's coming from. Give me another example in Tanakh where somebody asks a question that they already know the answer to. Yafeh. Who does God ask? God asks Cain and God asks Adam v'Chava. When God says to Adam v'Chava, God says to Adam, Ayeka, where are you? God knew very well. Why does God say to him, Ayeka, knowing the answer? God wants to give him an opportunity to admit. When God says to Cain, where is your brother Hevel? Cain should have said, well, what does Cain say? Oh, what am I, his brother? Which means that when God opens up with a question in Tanakh, it seems to be that that's right. It's an opening to indicate that, wait a minute, you need to rethink what has happened here. So the question in and of itself to the reader of Tanakh, who's supposed to know all of Tanakh, already indicates to us that this might indicate a little bit of Hagar is not so innocent here.
I think also that he's saying, where are you coming from, reminding her that she's left royalty on her own, and she's, where are you going to? She chose to be the maidservant of Sarah.
Okay.
And she's forgetting that, remember, what you left.
Let's take a look at page 5, verse, source 6. Page 5, verse 6 is a famous Rashi on the words, where are you coming from? Rashi says, Yada haya. The Malach knew very well where she was coming from. Ella liten la petach likanes ima bidvarim. God wants to introduce, give her a chance, just like Cain, just like Adam. Okay? But then the Sfarno says, as you're saying, the Sfarno says, Eimi zebat v'anatelchi. The reason he asked the question this way is he's supposed to say, hey, Biti, look, uri'i me'eza makom nasat. Look where you left. Ki hayit b'makom kadosh b'veit tzadikim. You were in the house of tzadikim in makom kadosh, v'hine holechet b'chutz la'aretz. You're leaving the land of Israel. Doesn't matter where you're going. Just the fact that you've left the land of Israel, El Makom Tamei Va'anshe Resha. By the way, we have another hint about Kedushat Eretz Yisrael, a little commercial message in this chapter. So one is here, the Sfarno, and does anybody know what the other one is? If you look at Pasuk Gimel, Pasuk Gimel, it specifically says to us that they were 10 years in the land. Why is that significant? There is a halacha that if a couple is married 10 years and they don't have a child, they should fight if it can be. However, if that couple comes to the land of Israel, we start counting the 10 years again because of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. So here we have two references in this chapter of Kedushat Eretz Yisrael, and that is exactly what the Malach is saying to her. Look where you're coming from and where you are going. And it puts her into that company. Now here, in that case, we do need to ask ourselves, would the Malach send her back to a situation that is so intolerable? Would the Malach, if it wasn't supposed to be, the Malach specifically stresses Shifcha Gvirti, reminding her of their of her place. Now, if indeed that is true, we have a problem here with the word V'hit Ani in Pasuk Tet, right? Where the Malach says, allow yourself to be afflicted, and Pasuk 11. What do we have in Pasuk 11?
That she will get pregnant.
Oh, so I'll talk about that in a minute. But you'll notice that it says here, Ki Shama Hashem et Onyech. He's God heard your suffering. Well, if she wasn't suffering, that's right, say that she wasn't so bad, then what's God hearing? So suffering is all just a matter of perspective. Everybody has a different tolerance level, and God is accepting her cries, justified or not justified. That's one possibility. If you follow the Radak and the Ramban, what's God hearing? Her clear suffering. If you follow the Hammurabi, or you follow this idea that she wasn't, what suffering could God be listening to? Where is she? In the desert. Okay? Single woman traveling the desert, it could well be that that is the suffering that God is listening to, and that God, and that's why perhaps God finds her at the well. Maybe there's no water there, maybe she can't get the rock off of the top of it. There are a million things that could happen, hypothetically, and that's what the Malach says, that God heard your suffering. Now, you ask about the Hinah Hara, behold, you are pregnant. Rashi here says, see, this is not really part of our discussion, I'll just throw it out to you. Rashi here says that she actually had a miscarriage. Running out desert, no water, which seems logical to us, and the angel says to her, don't worry, you will become pregnant again, and you will have a son, and he will be called Yishmael. Now, you'll notice something else here of interest. What is the promise that she gets? Not only does she have a son, but look in verse 12. What is the major promise that God is giving him? Now here's another idea. We grew up as children saying, V'hu yeh pera adam. How did we translate pera adam as children? As a wild man. Nahon. That's how we grew up, that Yishmael is going to be a wild man. But what exactly, why is that exactly a blessing to her? And why would that comfort her? So according to Rabbi Samet, and he bases this, for those of you who are interested, on a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Yirmiyahu bet chaftalet, and Iov, lamitet zayin, where in both places, para adam means, take a guess, free man. Para adam means a free, not what, somebody who's wild, think about it, means that they can run free. So that's where it comes from. Now, why would that be a significant piece? She, we said, if we follow that whole Hammurabi business, what's really bothering her is that lack of freedom. And here the Malach says to her, go back, hit ani, allow yourself to be afflicted, put yourself back into that position of maidservant, but know that your child, he will be free.
Where was it?
It's Yirmiyahu 2:24. And Eov 39:7, where para adam means free, and Rashi, Ibn Ezra there, interprets free among people. So that Hagar is being promised a freedom for her children, and if you think about it for a minute, Yishmael, with the nomadic lifestyle, the whole concept of nomadic lifestyle is that you have to answer to no one, and that you just pick up and move depending on where you are.
So,
I think.
Before, that doesn't make sense.
What should it be? I don't know what to tell you about that, the language. I don't know what that language is. I can't tell you that. But so therefore, so we have two readings here of the chapter, and I think that both so far are legitimate. We have the Radak Ramban, who says this is a very critical chapter of Sarah and Avraham, and even though the Malach tells her to go back, the Malach says, well, this is the way the world works. Or you have Rabbi Samet, who's following this discovery of the Hammurabi, who says, no, it's not such a critical of Avraham and Sarah, because the Malach comes along and says, go back, this is what it is, and accept your position. I do want to throw out one more approach, and that is we've looked at this chapter only as the individual chapter. What happens when we put this chapter into the context of Parshat Lech Lecha? What is the ongoing theme in the stories of Lech Lecha and Vayera? The theme that most of the stories are all, it's the fulfillment of the Haftacha on one hand, and on the flip side of it, it's all the things that make the fulfillment of that Haftacha difficult, what we have known in our lexicon as the Nisyonot of Avraham, the test of Avraham. 10 tests are being told about in those chapters. Now, if you think about it for a brief moment, you will notice that all of those 10 tests of Avraham affect Sarah in a major way. She is a major player in all of those 10 tests of Avraham. Now, the first test in Lech Lecha, God says to them, leave. And what's going to happen when you get to your new land? I will bless you and I will make you into a great nation. Here they are in the land 10 years and no nation. Okay? So that this becomes, we are used to thinking that the test here of Avraham is that Avraham has to take a second wife. That's the way we're used to thinking. But perhaps the test of Avraham is not the taking of the second wife, but the test of Avraham is the second wife actually becoming pregnant. Because if you were Avraham, what might you be thinking? And if you were Sarah, what might you be thinking in this perek?
It's coming from Sarah.
That radak that we saw before, that indeed the promise that I will make you a great nation and the promise that you will become the father of multiple nations, all that is going to come not through Avraham and Sarah, but just as Hagar is thinking, it's very possible that Avraham and Sarah are thinking that as well. And if you take a look at source 7, Sarah says to Avraham in Pasuk Hey that she is upset with him. Chamasi alecha. Rashi says, why is she angry at Avraham? Chamasi alecha, may my injustice be upon you, for the injustice that has been done to me. I lay punishment upon you. When you prayed to God, in the chapter before our chapter, Avraham turns to God and says, Mati teinli va'anochi holech ariri. What will you give you, for I am childless? And he's afraid that Eliezer is going to inherit him. And God says to him, Sarah says, you prayed only for yourself. Whereas should you have prayed for both of us, then I would have been remembered with you. So the question is, and this is obviously, if you follow that second opinion, that she thought that by giving Hagar, it would give her a merit to have a child. So the test here becomes not a test of, do you believe God is going to give you children, but the test becomes, do you believe that the nation is going to become from Abraham and Sarah? And when Hagar starts making fun of Sarah and saying, I'm going to be the mistress of Am Yisrael, I'm going to be, she's essentially not only taking Sarah's place, but she's essentially questioning the promise that God had given to Sarah and Abraham at Lech Lecha Me'artzecha. According to the Netziv, which you don't have in front of you, but the Netziv says like this, Sarah was doing the right thing. I remember Radak and Rabban came along and said Sarah was completely wrong. The Netziv comes along and says Sarah was actually doing the right thing because she was defending the honor of God. There are certain kavods that you cannot be mochel on. As a parent, kid says, can I sit in your seat? You can say, sure, sweetie, sit in my seat. If you're the king and somebody says to you and says, can you sit in my seat? No, you cannot sit in my seat. And if you sit in my seat, I cut off your head. So God, you cannot be mochel on the kavod of God. And mocking Sarah is like mocking God and his promise. And therefore, Sarah has no choice but to react in a harsh and strong way. So, by the way, just to take a look at that, if you look now also at source 8 on your page, source 8 tells us next week when Avram kicks out Sarah, Hagar, Kolash, the pasuk says, as you know, Kolash etumari lecha Sarah shma bekola. Everything you have to, Sarah says, you have to listen. Ma Talmud Lomar, what does Talmud Lomar teach us? Kol melameid shechriya l'shni'a hechriya l'rishona. This pasuk tells us that what's right the second time also is right retroactively. Ma shni'a odot Hagar, just the way she was right this time to kick out Hagar, af harishona al odot Hagar. Sarah was also justified there as well. And if you look at number 9, it's the Radak here who says something similar. Kevan sharata Sarai shelo yelda la'Avraham v'hu ben 80 v'chamesh v'hi bat 70 v'chamesh. When Sarah sees that Avraham is 86 and she is 70, he's 85, she's 75, they don't have children. Hashvaki ein la tikva od. She is beginning to give up hope. Amra, so she said, Hine, ki el amar la'Avraham, she itain lo zera shirash ha'aretz. God has told Abraham that he's going to have children who inherit the land. And it seems that there won't be any children from me. It seems to be that the child is going to be his. Therefore, it's appropriate that I give her as a maid. Vayishma Avram, and Avram hears. Ki chashav shecharesh Sarai bilta miledet mashi idu ha'el litet lo zera mehagar hiyeh. And that's why, so the Radak goes with this idea that she's actually dealing with the situation in a responsible way. The Netziv takes the complete opposite approach and says no, that she didn't give up hope, that she's actually hoping to have the baby, and that when Hagar is making fun of her, Hagar is actually mocking God as well. So where does this all leave us? This leaves us in a very gray position. And we spoke about this last week. The Torah is purposely gray, and that each and every reader has to read based on context, based on language, based on culture, decide what approach, and doesn't mean that you're not going to change your mind a number of years down the road. Mishlei is